From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyne. Today on the program, we try to add some context to the Winter Olympics, which start this week in Sochi. First, what Russia is trying to show to its own people and the world through hosting the Games. Then we'll learn about the Wisconsin contingent going to Sochi.
Wisconsin has 15 athletes participating in this coming Winter Olympics, and I believe that's tied for the fourth most by any state in the union, which kind of makes sense, right?
And training is obviously a huge part of making it to the Olympics, but what about eating?
Nutrition is huge. They have to be fueled appropriately in order to meet the training requirements for them and to meet the performance requirements of their sport.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyne. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The city of Sochi, Russia, is feverishly putting the finishing touches on preparations for the 2014 Winter Olympics. The opening ceremonies for the Games are set for Friday morning in Sochi, meaning they'll be broadcast in prime time tomorrow evening in the United States. But the Games have already been marked by controversy well before the first skiers have taken their runs and the first triple or even quadruple axels have been landed on the ice. Ongoing concerns about the threat of domestic terrorism marring the Games have led some families of Olympians to stay away from the Games, and disparaging remarks by Russian leaders, including President Vladimir Putin, about gays and lesbians have led to calls for protests and boycotts. But at the same time, the United States will send its largest delegation of athletes ever to the Winter Olympics. Gordon Hilton is professor at Marquette Law School, whose expertise includes both sports history and Russia. He joins us on the line this morning from Charlottesville, Virginia, where he's teaching this semester. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
As the Winter Olympic Games get underway, how important do you think they are in the context of Russia's place in the world community in 2014?
Well, I think the Russians certainly think they're very important. The whole post-Soviet history of Russia, at least the early part of it, was just one perceived national embarrassment after another. In a variety of ways, Russia is clearly back as a major world power, and this, I think, is an important way of emphasizing that point. At least the Russians see it that way.
Well, and I wonder if they're more important for Russia in terms of presenting its face to the rest of the world, or Russia in presenting its face to itself, if you will.
Well, I think it's important for both. I think it was important for the Putin government to prove that it could do this, even on what initially sounded absurd, to have the Winter Olympics at a warm water Black Sea port. It seemed crazy at first. But so I think it's important for Russia to prove that it can do this. So this isn't just putting on the Olympic Games. This is changing the climate. This is changing the weather. This is importing hundreds of thousands of tons of man-made snow. So I think this is Russia's way of saying that we can take on these monumental tasks and complete them effectively, both internally and externally.
And at the same time, in doing so, it runs a pretty significant risk, does it not?
Well, that's right. But I think the Russians are accustomed to taking risks.
I want to get back to the current games. But first, let's flash back some decades, in fact, maybe more than a century, and talk about the history of Russia and before that, the Soviet Union and the Olympic movement. Before they were an Olympic power, the Soviet Union had actually been out of the Olympics altogether. But before that, there were, if I'm not mistaken, Russian teams in the earliest modern games.
That's right. They were, I believe, original participant, and they certainly participated in the pre-1914 Olympic Games, I think without any particularly great success. But you're right. During the early history of the Soviet Union, the Games were viewed as a kind of form of capitalist exploitation, and it was not something that a socialist nation would support or participate. At least that was the official Soviet position. But clearly in the early 1950s, after the Second World War, in part as part of their larger Cold War policy, they decided not just to re-enter the Olympic movement, but to enter and attempt to dominate it, which they came very close to doing.
Well, and connect the dots for us. Why did the Olympic Games gel so much with what was their Cold War policy?
I think actually, ironically, the story really starts with Nazi Germany and Adolf Hitler's realization that a successful performance at the Olympic Games, and I'm talking about the 1936 Games in Berlin, both to demonstrate that Nazi Germany could host the Olympics and do so in a kind of spectacular fashion with new stadiums and new facilities, and that its athletes would win dozens of medals, was a way, at least sort of metaphorically or symbolically, vindicating the whole Nazi experiment. And I think really the use of the Olympic Games as a kind of tool of international diplomacy really dates back to the 1930s. And so in the early 50s, the Soviet Union, I think, launches a kind of similar effort.
Well, I'm wondering if there's a parallel to be drawn, and launch is a good word here, between how the Soviet Union viewed the Olympic Games and perhaps how it saw the space race.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, the devastation that the Soviet Union suffered during the Second World War, 50% of the total casualties Allied and Axis were Soviet casualties. So there was both a matter of for national security to put out a strong face to the rest of the world, but also to prove that Russia had endured and had emerged more with greater strength from the World War II experience was very important for Stalin and then his successors. And I think you're right. This just fit into that kind of larger strategy of showing to the world that the Soviet Union had not just survived the Second World War, but it had emerged as a great world power. The space race, the Olympics, there were a whole host of things were ways of demonstrating that.
Along the same lines as the question about who the games are valuable or how they're valued today, both as seen by the rest of the world and as seen by the Russian population, we think of the medal count in terms of its propaganda value. But who was the propaganda directed towards? When the Soviet Union won, say, you know, so many medals in ice hockey, for example, did that speak more to the rest of the world or to its own population as a way of, you know, validating that, you know, we're on the right course here?
It certainly was a way of validating the acts of the government and the general policies in the Soviet era with the Soviet population. But I think it was also a kind of ideological statement that a socialist theory of sport could produce greater athletic achievement than a capitalist theory of sport. So I think this was not entirely just a matter of Mother Russia trying to reassert herself, but there also was an important ideological component to all this.
So then 1980 happens, and there are two significant developments worth mentioning. There is, of course, the U.S. Miracle on Ice hockey team at Lake Placid on U.S. soil when the great underdogs, the United States, beat this, you know, powerhouse Soviet Union team. And then the U.S. turns around and boycotts the 1980 Summer Games in Moscow after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. How pivotal was 1980 to Russia in terms of its Olympic history?
It was a real blow to the Soviets, I think, that the United States would do this for what to them, I think, just looked like yet another kind of border protection incursion, their movement into Afghanistan in the late 70s. The idea that the Carter administration would link the Olympics to these questions of East-West power relationships, I think, was a great insult to the Soviets. And of course, as a result, they boycotted the Summer Olympics in 1984 in Los Angeles. So it really did, it meant for two consecutive Summer Olympics, the best athletes of the world were not all there.
Well, and so more recently, you know, since the fall of the Soviet Union, as you said, Russia has had its challenges economically and on the world stage. Russia has still had a fair degree of success in some areas in the Olympics. Have sports been a bright spot nationalistically, if you will, for Russia in the days since the Soviet Union has fallen?
Well, I think there are really two phases to this. In the immediate aftermath of the collapse and the dismemberment of the Soviet Union, the amount of Russian funding for sports declined fairly precipitously, and there was this large exodus of Russian athletes, particularly hockey players, to the West. So I think the whole Russian sporting establishment, it didn't exactly collapse, but it certainly suffered badly in the years following the end of the Soviet Union. On the other hand, over the last decade, with the resurgence of the Soviet Union, and particularly the involvement of Russian billionaires in the sports industry, not just in Russia, but around the world, there's really been a real resurgence of Soviet commitment, at least economic commitment, into the world of sports. But even at the low point, Russian athletes did quite well in the Olympic Games. In fact, something that fascinates me is that if you actually, for the last several Olympics, if you were to add the total medal accounts for all of the 15 former Soviet Socialist Republics, what was once the USSR is now competing as 15 different countries, if you added all those medals together, it would vastly exceed the totals for the United States or China or Britain. There has been no fall off in what used to be Soviet accomplishment in the Olympics. It's just now divided between 15 countries, and while the bulk of the successes with Russia, Ukraine, and Kazakhstan have typically won in the neighborhood of 20 medals, and all the SSRs win something.
So let's flash forward now to 2014, and you know there have been contradictory reports in terms of the cost of these games, how much they're costing to put on. Obviously, President Putin is saying one thing. There are some accounts that the true number is many times his estimate. You were just in Russia not long ago. How are the games being viewed, you know, from an economic standpoint and from a national pride standpoint within the country?
I wasn't really there in a situation that really allowed me to form an opinion about the economic sense, but it's clear that this is a major source of national pride. In fact, one thing that struck me is that, I don't know if you've been in the Moscow airport, but there are dozens of high-end shops there. And you wonder at first, who comes to the airport to buy jewelry, right? Who comes to the airport to buy these expensive consumer items? But I realize in a way that those airport shops are about showing to the world, at least as it passes through the Moscow airport, that this is a rich country. This is a country on the cutting edge of technology. This is a country that's sort of showing off. It's telling the world we're back. And I think the way in which the Olympic Games are being portrayed in the Soviet Union is, as you mentioned earlier, it's largely motivated by a desire to convince the Russian people that Russia is back. Russia is a world power. Russia is a country that needs to be taken seriously by all the other countries of the world. So I think that Putin is playing this brilliantly as a domestic issue.
From an international standpoint, though, there seem to be some missteps. One of the stories that has gained the most traction leading up to the games in the West is Putin's statements about whether gays are welcome at the games. Is this an international misstep, and does it really mean anything to Putin within his own country?
Of course, this is an issue that is starting to divide the world. There is nothing really radical in the Russian context about Putin's position. I mean, it is the traditional, I'm sure, if anyone had really thought about it, this was the way in which Russians have always felt. And it's a way, much of the third world, Africa, certainly still feels. So I think it's not going to hurt Putin domestically. But I think there is the problem of Russia now looking like a kind of coarse bully to the rest of the world. And I'm not sure that this particular approach to crack down on homosexual activity, and particularly the publication of pro-homosexual viewpoints, to kind of link that crackdown to the Olympic Games probably was a kind of a strategic error, at least vis-a-vis the way in which the West is now perceiving Russia. It politicized the games in a way that they did not necessarily have to be politicized.
Well, and what about the security concerns? What do you make of them? It's certainly not the kind of publicity I imagine Russia would want to be having for the games in the immediate run-up to the games themselves.
I think that's true, although for 20 years, Russia has had to deal with sort of dissidents in Dagestan and Chechnya. So, and Russia has been living with Islamic terrorism for the last two decades. So I don't think this was something that they weren't aware of. I think what they're counting on is that there will not be any significant events, and that this will prove that not only can Russia put on an elaborate and impressive set of games in a bizarre location, but that it can make them entirely safe. Now, obviously, this will backfire if, in fact, there are terrorist attacks or the Black Widows are able to filter through. So it's a risk, but, Putin's whole career has been that of a risk taker.
Would you expect these games come off pretty well?
I'm hoping they do. I don't have any reason to think. It seems to me the Russians are using rather extraordinary and even somewhat brutal methods to try to make sure there are no terrorist incidents. Just some of the stories that have been reported recently about their efforts to try to ferret out potential terrorists in Dagestan and Chechnya. So I have my fingers crossed there'll be no such episodes. But of course, you know, we won't know until the games are over. The International Olympic Committee has done a rather surprisingly good job in cooperating with the Russians on these security issues. I don't think there's ever been a set of Olympic Games where the IOC itself has been as deeply committed to security as these games. So it's really like there are sort of two parties who are trying to make these games safe.
Well, Gordon Hilton, thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us.
All right. Well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Gordon Hilton is a professor at Marquette Law School. His expertise includes both Russia and sports history. Hilton is teaching this semester at the University of Virginia, and he joined us on the line from Charlottesville. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. I'm Mitch Teich. I'm joined in the studio this morning by Bonnie North. We are into day five of an Olympic effort of our own, our winter membership drive.
Exactly. We don't have to land triple salchows or quadruples or anything like that, or go down that long, what is it, the ski jump, you know, the 120-meter
right.
hill or anything like that. But what we do have to do is raise $160,000 by Friday morning. And we'll wrap everything up just in time for us to enjoy the Olympics.
Might seem like an Olympic achievement, but...
But it's a very simple one, actually. The equation is easy. You simply pick up the phone and call 414-227-3210, or you go to the website wuwm.com/give, and you make your donation of support.
We do have this Winter Olympics theme on today's show, and it really, it's a good example of how we take ostensibly an international event, an event that's getting attention from around the world by hundreds, thousands of media sources, but we make it really relevant to our listening audience here in Milwaukee. It's stories about Russian and international politics. It's stories about the Wisconsin athletes who are going to the games. It's stories about nutrition, like we'll hear later on in the program. Support great programming that really takes the macro and makes it micro by calling us now, 414-227-3210, or go online to wuwm.com/give. Wisconsin will be well represented at this year's Winter Games. Sports contributor Howie Magner joins us with a sort of who's who of Wisconsin Winter Olympians when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. We're getting ready for the Winter Olympics on today's show. We talked international politics and Russian sports history before the break, but we're going to shift to sports themselves. Now, there will be a large contingent of Wisconsin athletes at the Winter Games. In fact, plenty of countries would be happy to have a contingent of Wisconsin's size. There was also, we should mention, another big sporting event that just happened with a couple of athletes with Wisconsin connections. We like to call it the Super Bowl. Howie Magner is our sports contributor, and he's with us in the studio now to discuss both of those events. How's it going, Howie?
Mitch, it's always an extreme pleasure to be here.
We're about a day away from the opening ceremonies of the 2014 Winter Olympics, and we are going to get to Wisconsin's role in the Winter Games in just a minute. But it's hard to let the opportunity go by without at least briefly mentioning the Super Bowl, which involved no teams from Wisconsin, but several significant players with Wisconsin ties. But let me get your review. What the heck happened to the Denver Broncos?
I think the Denver Broncos simply ran into the best defense that the NFL has seen since the 1985 Chicago Bears. And they didn't have an answer for it. And then things kept snowballing. They kept making mistakes and Seattle kept capitalizing. And eventually it got too far out of reach. You know, it's great if you're a Russell Wilson fan and you saw him hoist the Vince Lombardi trophy just barely, not even 3 years after he was playing for your Wisconsin Badgers. Monte Ball, the story wasn't quite as happy on his end. But either way, if you were a Badgers fan, you were going to have a hometown guy to celebrate. But I think a lot of people going into the Super Bowl thought that really either team could win. I think they saw it as being an even matchup. And I certainly certainly wouldn't have been surprised if Denver won or if Seattle won. I think what surprised people was the magnitude of the blowout. And it started going bad for the Broncos early, about as early as it could on that opening snap when they snapped the ball into their own end zone and got a safety. And it kept piling up and piling up. The defense actually held on pretty well
early on in the game. The story is frequently cast in terms of what a great defense Seattle had. Denver's defense did not play badly, at least in the first half.
Yeah, it went about as well as it could for Denver's defense, given everything that was going against the Broncos. You know, they held Seattle to a field goal and kept it to 5-0, then to 8-0. And then they could have held him to another field goal had Denver not committed a stupid pass interference penalty in the end zone. And that led to Seattle's next touchdown. Then, of course, Peyton Manning gets intercepted for a pick six right before halftime. And things are really looking bleak. And then they look even worse when Seattle comes out of the halftime and takes the opening kickoff back for a touchdown. The game was basically over then. So it certainly wasn't the result that you expected. But in light of that, I think you can safely say Seattle was the best team in the NFL this season. And they might be around for quite some time. They were showing some graphics on screen that Seattle is tied for the youngest team in average age of a Super Bowl champion. And so they can hang on to those guys and they can be a force to be reckoned with for quite some time, which isn't necessarily good news for Green Bay Packers fans.
You know, one of the sidebars to this story leading up to the Super Bowl was the place of Peyton Manning in football history. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about him being, you know, the greatest regular season quarterback ever and still never being able to quite pull off that distinction in the postseason, especially the Super Bowl. This past Super Bowl will do nothing to quell that kind of discussion.
No, if anything, it adds fuel to the fire that Peyton Manning is the quarterback who can't win the big one. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that's taken to the extreme sometimes. I think a lot of times you put too much emphasis on how a player performs in one game, big though that game might be. And look no further than the legacy of John Elway to see how that played out. You know, John Elway, before he won his two Super Bowl championships in the last 2 years of his career, was looked at as nothing but a playoff failure because he had lost three Super Bowl championships. Now, because he won two games back-to-back, the second one largely on the back of Terrell Davis, Elway is considered one of the best quarterbacks in the history of the league. I think Peyton Manning will be considered one of the best quarterbacks in the history of the league. I think this was a missed opportunity on his part and on Denver's part to quell a lot of those critics. The only thing he can do is come back next year and try to win another one. And given Denver's circumstances, you would think that's a pretty good chance, but they've got a lot of free agents. There's no guarantee they'll be as good next year as they were this year.
Well, that's the big sporting spectacle that has recently happened. Let's talk about the big sporting spectacle that's about to happen. The Winter Olympics are about to get underway with the U.S. team having a pretty nice Wisconsin flavor to it.
Yeah, maybe this will help some of those Broncos fans take their mind off the Super Bowl, right? they've got the Olympics to look forward to. But you sent me something that said Wisconsin has 15 athletes participating in this coming Winter Olympics. And I believe that's tied for the fourth most by any state in the union, which kind of makes sense, right? I mean, here we are up north and they play these Winter Olympics on a lot of frozen surfaces. And so it seems like a natural match. I'm looking forward to seeing not just how the Wisconsin athletes do, but how the U.S. team in general does. I've been a longtime Olympic fan. And if you're about as old as me, some might even say older. So
some might.
your first Winter Olympic memory is probably my first Winter Olympic memory, which was the Miracle on Ice in 1980 when the U.S. hockey team shocked the world and beat the Russians and really helped uplift a nation. And I've always enjoyed the strike while the iron is hot stories and the, you know, 4 years comes down to a split second of performance. I've liked that angle of the Olympics and I like the amateur angle and I like the fact that you can be a guy driving a delivery truck one day and the next day be on a stage in front of the entire world. So I'm really looking forward to seeing the next fortnight play out.
Well, and we can start with hockey, speaking of the Miracle on Ice, but let's start with women's hockey. And we should note, you know, the Winter Olympics are about frozen surfaces. We are not really an alpine state, so most of our athletes ply their trade on ice as opposed to snow. There is at least one pretty amazing story of a Wisconsin athlete, women's hockey player, already as the Olympics are getting underway.
Yeah, Amanda Kessel, a lot of people don't know this, but Amanda Kessel out of Madison, Wisconsin, is basically the best U.S. female hockey player. And she's had some big moments in a relatively young career. I think she's only 22 years old. And the U.S. beat Team Canada in the 2013 World Cup Championship, and Amanda scored the winning goal. So she really is carrying the flag for the women's hockey team, and they probably have the best chance of winning a gold medal.
I think that they are the prohibitive favorites right
now. Yeah, I think so. It's basically, women's hockey has basically been a two-team sport between the U.S. and Canada. And in fact, the gap between U.S. and Canada and other teams has been so big that there was talk of ditching women's hockey in the Olympics because there was no competitive balance. But the U.S. has actually had Team Canada's number in recent years. So the U.S. women are the favorites. Amanda is going to carry the torch for them. And there's also a few other players from Wisconsin on the women's hockey team. Brianna Decker, I think a lot of folks from Badgers fans will certainly remember her.
We should note Amanda Kessel, for being from Madison, actually played for the University of Minnesota.
I wasn't going to get into that because I didn't want to upset a lot of Badgers fans. I don't know what the backstory is behind her leaving her hometown of Madison and going on to Minnesota. I'm sure some folks do. But the other thing is she's got a brother, Phil Kessel, who's going to be on the men's team, the men's U.S. Olympic team. And that looks like, obviously, the men are not the prohibitive favorite that the U.S. women are.
There's a lot of competitive parity in that.
Exactly. We're not exactly the hockey powerhouse in the world. Although the experts will tell you that the U.S. Are going to be one of four teams fighting for the three medals, the others being, of course, the favorite Canada, Sweden has a very strong team, and then Russia, which has the added benefit of playing on its home ice in Sochi. So it should be a pretty interesting tournament.
Well, let's talk about another ice-based sport, and that is speed skating. People know fairly well that many of the elite speed skaters on especially the long track team, but some from the short track team too, call Milwaukee home as far as their base of training. There's some really nice stories about people on the U.S. speed skating team who hail from this part of the world.
Hail's Corners, if you will. Allie Dudek, folks might recognize the name because 4 years ago she brought home a bronze medal in the women's 3,000-meter short track speed skating, really. Short track is one of my favorite sports to watch. And one of the reasons why is because there's a lot of chaos that goes on. If you remember a few years back, there was a famous gold medal race involving Apollo Anton Ono, and I think it was a five-man race. And they were all coming around the last turn, and I believe Apollo Anton Ono was in front. And then there was like a four-man wreck. So they all crashed into the wall. The guy who was a distant fifth ended up winning the whole race and took the gold medal. And I think Ono got his skate across for the silver medal. But it's the unpredictability. They skate in such tight packs. They're taking such sharp turns. And they're going so fast that it's really an action-packed race. And I think that really makes it an attractive sport to watch, particularly on TV. And I actually asked Allie Dudek for an article in the recent issue of Milwaukee Magazine how she handles that chaos affecting her chances of success. And she said it's a realistic thing that you've got to worry about. And they actually talk to sports psychologists about how to deal with that. And they really have to be good at compartmentalizing results. If something bad happens in the previous race, there's nothing you can do about it. You have to just refocus quickly on your next race. She is probably not a medal favorite. She was basically the third qualifier of the three-woman team from the U.S. But again, It's short track speed skating. Anything can happen. She skates well. A couple of chaotic things happen, and she could be coming home with another medal to give company to her bronze medal, which, by the way, she keeps in the sock drawer of her dresser, giving her easy access whenever she takes it out to do school time show and tell speeches.
Well, if short track is kind of organized chaos, long track is a much different phenomenon. But there are plenty of long trackers with Wisconsin ties who are going to be in the Olympics, not the least of whom is a pretty likable figure who graduated from Wauwatosa East High School in 2008.
Aptly named, right? Sugar Todd. I have not had the pleasure of meeting Sugar, but Claire Hannon in our Milwaukee Magazine office actually knows her through some acquaintances and says she really does live up to her name. She really is a sweet person. She's probably not a medal favorite. In fact, I don't think any of the long trackers from Wisconsin, if you go to Tucker Fredericks or Mitch Whitmore, I don't think any of them are considered long track medal favorites. But you're right about the contrast in the sports. You look at long track, and it's almost scientific in comparison to short track speed skating. It's all about pace and rhythm. And
you're really racing against yourself
exactly.
In some ways.
It wouldn't be unheard of if somebody gets to the Olympics and suddenly has a career day and surprises people. But the nature of long track makes it a little bit more predictable. Actually, one would say a lot more predictable than short track.
We should note that one of the medal favorites, however, Shawnee Davis,
right.
Is from Illinois but uses the Pettit National Ice Center as his base of training.
Right. You almost think of Shawnee as being an adopted Wisconsinite because he spends so much time here training. Now, he is a favorite.
Brian Hansen as well.
Yep. And so there certainly could be some medals coming from people with Wisconsin ties, even if they're not originally from Wisconsin.
And before we wrap up, let's mention the Olympic curling team. And also there's a Wisconsinite on the skeleton team as well.
Skeleton. A lot of people don't even know what that is. They're probably more familiar
like luge with
luge.
Less equipment.
Well, it's luge facing the other direction. So instead of going down the bobsled track feet first, in skeleton you're going down head first, which if you ask me just makes them completely crazy. Matt Antoine apparently is gotten hot at the right time. He's won a couple of World Cup medals recently, and people think that he's got an outside shot to win a medal in Sochi. He might not be the favorite, but if things break right, he could bring a medal home. But curling, you know, Mitch, I wanted to ask you about curling because I don't
curled,
know
yes.
that a lot of people know your affinity for the sport of curling. And for those who don't know what curling is, it's basically shuffleboard on ice with giant rocks. And there are a couple of Wisconsinites who are going to be on both the men's and women's team. The brother-sister combo of Craig and Erica Brown are going to be on the team, and Debbie McCormick. And I know you have experience for curling, so you tell us, Mitch Tyke, what should we expect? Why should we watch curling?
Curling is all about the mental game, and if you are someone who likes watching baseball games because you can see how the outfield shifts for a particular batter with a particular pitcher on the mound, or you like how the infield positions itself, you like the mental game that goes on between the batter and the pitcher, for example. Curling is one of those things where you are not just shooting a large rock for this turn, but you are setting something up to happen two or three or four shots down the road. People are setting up guards. They're, basically knocking each other's rocks out of the way so that the person who goes next will have a better place to shoot. There's a lot going on. It is, I would say, not necessarily something that you should watch if you're craving a great deal of imminent danger or or overt excitement, on the other hand. But, you know, the number of Wisconsinites involved on the U.S. teams, both men and women, might be reason enough to watch.
Fair enough. Mitch, thanks for joining us today.
Howie, thank you. Howie Magner is senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine and writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website. He's also our regular sports contributor. A very regular contributor to Lake Effect is also in the studio with us right now. Bonnie North is standing by because we are into day five of the winter membership drive. Bonnie, how's
yes.
it going?
Well, we're doing really well. We're trying to raise $700 this hour. We're well on our way. Things are counting down for us on the drive. We hope to make a total of $160,000 by Friday morning. So the way you help and be part of that equation is you go to the website wuwm.com/give or you call 414-227-3210. Become an active member or renew your active membership and become part of the equation.
Well, and Bonnie, you raised the idea of $160,000 being our goal, and we can make an Olympic comparison here. You know, when the first Olympic athlete crosses the finish line in a race of sorts, it's over. You know, he's won or she's won. You know, you still have second and third place. There is no second or third place in pledge drive world. When we reach $160,000, this drive will end. So you can help make that a success. Help us win the gold medal of membership drives. Wow, that was a tenuous connection, wasn't it?
What a good one.
414-227-3210 or go online to wuwm.com/give. We're going to talk Olympic nutrition after the break, but there's a nutrition-related incentive for people to make their contribution right now.
There certainly is. This is the drawing for anyone who contributes to the Winter On Air Membership Drive. You don't have to contribute, of course, but we hope that you will. And this is Dinner for Two in Chicago at the Michelin-starred Moto Restaurant, 14 courses with wine pairings. You're going to need an Olympic training event after that. A private indoor farm tour because they grow most of their own vegetables. And there's also a private cooking class as well. Somebody will win that. It's very simple. You just call 414-227-3210 or you go to wuwm.com/give. And we thank you so much for everyone who's already done that.
Another break now, and then we'll continue with this theme of Olympic proportions and talk about how to eat like a high-performance athlete. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Tyke. We've been setting the stage for the Winter Olympics, which open on Friday morning in Sochi, Thursday evening, our time. If you spend any time watching the Winter Games, you're likely to see a barrage of commercials in which athletes sing the praises of their food-related sponsors, from McDonald's and Subway to Kashi breakfast cereal. But what does the diet of an Olympic athlete really look like, or taste like, for that matter? Kristen Kipp has some insight in that area. She currently works as the wellness coordinator at Marquette University, but she's also a registered dietitian and certified strength and conditioning specialist. She joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
When we think about the training regimen that an Olympic athlete or any elite athlete has to go through, how big a part of the equation is nutrition?
Yeah, nutrition is huge. They have to be fueled appropriately in order to meet the training requirements for them and to meet the performance requirements of their sport.
They can do all the adequate strength conditioning and endurance conditioning that they want, but if they're not eating right and appropriately, this could spell the difference between performing well and not performing well?
Right. Athletes need to fuel their bodies appropriately to perform. In order to train to their highest potential, they're going to have to eat the right amount of foods at the right times as well. So they're going to have to make sure that they're fueling their body before their workout. They're going to have to make sure they're getting, you know, their recovery foods in. You know, that's the only way that they're going to meet their performance levels.
Well, so let's talk about that timing. How does nutrition as a way to get ready for competition differ from nutrition in recovery? That is, you know, how do athletes need to eat differently, say, the night before a major competition versus how they should eat after it's done?
The general rule of thumb is that we're not going to eat a meal earlier than 3 to 4 hours before the event. They're going to maybe have a small snack 1 to 2 hours before. The night before, they're probably having a carbohydrate-rich meal and probably lower fat, easier to digest, but kind of loading up for the next day. After they perform their event, their recovery nutrition needs to have a little bit of carbohydrates and a little bit of protein, and there's really a window of opportunity. You know, the first 30 to 60 minutes after exercise to eat, that's the best time to replace those muscle glycogen stores. It's the best time for protein synthesis to occur, and so they need to be paying attention. So having, you know, some chocolate milk, half a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, something like that to help their recovery.
I keep hearing about chocolate milk, and what is it about chocolate milk versus white milk that makes it such a good energy supplement?
Chocolate milk has the right amount of carbohydrates and protein needed for recovery. It's also got some just, you know, basic sugars in them that are great for that muscle glycogen synthesis as well.
Well, and, you know, what often feels like it's missing from the conversation is taste. And I would imagine there's something to chocolate milk as, you know, something that an athlete would enjoy drinking after a big race or a big competition.
Right. It does. It tastes great. It's easy. It's nice and portable. It's a quick snack.
Well, and we talked about taste as far as chocolate milk goes, but what about the idea that athletes ought to be eating things that maybe feel right for their situation, that, you know, that their bodies are speaking to them as they're exercising or getting ready?
I think there's, you know, there's something to it. If you're hungry for something, your body's probably craving it. It probably means that you need it. So if you want to have a hamburger or whatever it is, you should eat it because your body probably needs something from that.
Using some common sense, of course, though.
Right. Not eating a big meal before a race.
Which is why you don't see Shawnee Davis standing there and eating a cheeseburger right before he gets on the ice.
Right.
Is there a tricky balance to this equation during something like the Olympics in which an athlete might have to perform at a high level either every day for 4 or 5 days in a row or have multiple heats of a race on the same day? And so they're fueling up and then they're expending energy and then they have to go right back out and perform again?
I don't know if there's a special trick to it, but they're definitely going to have to, you know, make sure that they're getting all of those nutrition needs and that they're going to have, you know, food with them, depending on their sport, too. You know, you have to think about, are they on the hill, you know, skiing? And are the foods going to freeze? That kind of thing. But they're going to have to plan ahead. And that's what the great thing. They have the dietitians there to help them do that.
Well, and, you know, most of us have seen athletes in long distance events or endurance events. And sometimes they're scarfing down squeeze packs of food and Gatorade. Or in the case of, you know, you watch the Tour de France and people are handing them, you know, cheeseburgers. Burgers as the event is going on. What is ideal in terms of refueling as exercise is going on?
Well, you want something that's easy to digest. And for athletes, it's probably very individual. You know, what can they take? For some, you know, they jelly beans may work. Some can do the protein bars or
the goo or whatever.
Goo,
yeah,
yes,
exactly.
Thank you. Something like that. Some, you know, but some people can't stomach that as well. So it's really what they're able to handle. You don't want to have anything high in fat that's going to be harder to digest. So something easy to digest. And, you know, liquids are great for that because they can go right in or generally easy on the stomach.
Most of us have also heard about the idea of carb loading ahead of a big race or a big competition. And I guess we've known about this concept for a long time. Is there some debate about the degree to which carbs ought to play such a key role? I mean, nowadays, we also hear that too many carbs can get you fat.
Right. Well, for athletes, you know, carbs really are the energy source for their sport. They have to have enough, you know, and depending on the type of sport that they're doing as well, that's going to play a role.
Well, and that's another good point because, you know, I would gather that someone who's an endurance athlete has much different nutrition needs than someone who is, you know, say, a weightlifter or a baseball player or, you know, someone who does high intensity for a fairly short amount of time but doesn't have to make that nutrition last over, you know, 2 and 3 and 4 hours.
Right. And somebody who's in a nutrition sport's got to be fueled up appropriately and then has got to have those snacks during the race, depending on how long it's going to keep them going.
What are the most common mistakes that people make or misconceptions people have about eating in athletic training?
Yeah, I think if they're not practicing as they're training and know what their body's able to handle during the event, that can be a problem. Also, again, eating too soon before an event can have an impact as well. We don't want to eat a big meal before the event. You're going to have a smaller amount of food, lower fat, that kind of thing.
You mentioned chocolate milk. What about sports drinks, you know, the Powerades and the Gatorades of the world? Do they play as important a role as the people who make Gatorade and Powerade would like you to believe?
Well, they're easy to digest, you know, a great source of carbohydrates for them. Don't have the protein in there for recovery. So, you know, during a workout, during an event, you know, that would be a great source. But you can also make your own energy drink if you or a sports drink if you'd like.
How do you make your own energy drink or sports drink?
I don't think I have a recipe, but I think, you know, some water, some sugar, some, you know, flavoring, some salt. I don't have a great recipe for that.
Well, and finally, what about, you know, I know that athletes often train at intense levels for a while, then they ratchet it back, and maybe there's a period of rest in between major competitions. Should their eating habits be different when they are not necessarily undergoing a hard workout every day?
Well, their caloric requirements are going to be different, obviously. If they're not having the training volume during that off season, they're going to have to eat less. But the kinds of foods are going to be the same, you know, lean proteins, lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, that kind of thing, and, you know, fats from healthy food sources. So that isn't going to change. It's just going to be the amount that's different.
Well, very good. Kristen Kipp, thank you so much for adding some perspective to this for us.
Thank you.
Kristen Kipp is an employee wellness coordinator at Marquette University, a registered dietitian and certified strength and conditioning specialist. She was formerly a coordinator of remedial physical fitness programs in the Marine Corps. Over the 2 weeks of the Olympics, we'll see plenty of great athletic performances and hear plenty of athletic backstories. We're also likely to hear plenty of sports cliches and jargon past the lips of broadcasters and athletes. In sports, as in life, Lake Effect essayist Kip Friedman would prefer we skip the jargon.
It is what it is. What is? Know what I'm saying? No, not really. There you go. Where? I haven't budged from this spot. When people speak in meaningless, confusing, and pretentious-sounding catchphrases and jargon, my first thought is, I have no idea what they are saying. Of course, we live in a civil society. Who lives in an uncivil society? So I typically show restraint. A part of me realizes that those who speak in jargon are well-intentioned folks who are simply parroting phrases that literally fill in the cracks between conversational dead air. In the context of the conversation, they may even be conveying some kind of meaning, but I much prefer dead air to this verbal flatulence and laziness. Oh, sure, I know that I must come across as some kind of boorish elitist snob, but all's I'm saying, whoops, there I go again, is that this overuse of mindless, convoluted gibberish is hastening the decline of Western civilization. Okay, maybe I'm overstating this a bit, but at the very least, it is quite annoying. When all is said and done, jargon creep, like mission creep, has gotten way out of hand. Before you raise your hands in protest and sigh, c'est la vie, or roll your eyes and utter a dismissive, whatever, please understand that it must be stopped. Mark my words, one day President Ronald Reagan's enduring legacy will not be for having spoken the words, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, but for his other confusing, pointless phrase, there you go again. Although the Gipper rode that folksy, disarming expression all the way to the White House, everything happens for a reason, he would have been better served if he'd listened to his wife Nancy and just said no to jargon. I'm not sure where this annoying trend of spouting mindless, nonsensical phrases started. It seems to have taken a particular foothold in the business world, i.e. core competencies, think outside of the box, best practices, drinking the Kool-Aid. I wouldn't be surprised if there's always been jargon dating back to the beginning of the written word. I'm pretty certain Egyptologists who have deciphered ancient hieroglyphs have encountered papyrus scrolls laden with jargon-like decrees from the court of Ramses. What better way in which to obfuscate, sound knowledgeable, and persuasive all in the same breath? An entire industry of propagandists, aka public relations advertising professionals, can thank jargon for the ability to use miscommunication as an effective tool of communication and to make a handsome living. I was not shocked to learn in British historian Peter Green's marvelous accounts of Alexander the Great that the Macedonian king kept a fleet of PR flacks on retainer, singing his praises while leaking breaking news-like updates while young Alexander carved a victorious path through Persia and much of the ancient world. The scary thing is, when people speak in meaningless jargon, they actually think they are being articulate and profound, and perhaps even furthering the public discourse. Take the idiomatic phrase, it is what it is. A favorite of life coaches, motivational speakers, and middle managers everywhere, this silly phrase has acquired an almost zen-like mystical quality. Indeed, the term can be traced back to the Persian 13th century Sufi mystic writer Rumi. And yet, I'm pretty certain most people who use this expression are not imparting Rumi-like wisdom. Mostly, it's used in a prosaic way of stating the obvious. Man, it's cold outside. It is what it is. Gee, thanks. Now I get it. Shouldn't that expression be saved for something of major import? I have a difficult time accepting that the Higgs boson God particle theory may be responsible for all the mass in the universe. It is what it is. Better yet, it should not be used at all. There is, of course, a place for jargon, which is the language of professionals. But often jargon escapes from these highly technical fields into the general population and becomes a substitute for real thinking. Fortunately, jargon words and phrases fall out of favor. Many useless words and phrases have thankfully passed their expiration date like old milk and have been relegated to the dung heap of verbiage history. We can breathe a sigh of relief knowing that none of us are synergistic anymore and unless I'm mistaken, there haven't been that many paradigm shifts lately. Sadly, though, there are still many among us still recuperating from the trauma of reverse engineering. As surely as day follows night, there will always be a new crop of jargon words and phrases reaching for their moment in the sun, such as reimagining, that will be foisted upon an unsuspecting public like a virus. And while I'm on the subject of useless jargon, I'd like to take a moment to mention the bastard child of jargon, unnecessary superlatives. I once went to a Blockbuster video store, remember those? And the clerk asked, "Did you find everything okay?" When I answered in the affirmative, he responded in an enthusiastic, "Awesome!" Unless I missed something, there was nothing particularly awesome about that experience. I'm not sure what is awesome these days, but surely not a routine visit to a now-defunct video store chain. But for many, at the end of the day, moving forward, when all is said and done, spouting useless jargon and unnecessary superlatives is, apparently, wicked awesome and all good.
Essayist Kip Friedman's work has appeared online at Smith Magazine and the Huffington Post. He'll read from his memoir, Barracuda in the Attic, this Friday afternoon at the High Point Senior Living Facility in downtown Milwaukee. You've been listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. It's so great that you've been listening because we are on day 5 of our winter membership drive, and you've been helping make it a smashing success so far. I'm joined by Lake Effect's Bonnie North, who's in the studio, and we are on our way up to a pretty lofty, some might say, Olympian goal.
Yes, $160,000 total for the week of the winter membership drive. And this hour, though, only $700. And I think we're pretty darn close to that now, if not gone over. So thanks to you for calling 414-227-3210 or going to wuwm.com/give, making your donation of support and helping us end this drive with a gold medal.
And when you make that gift to 414-227-3210 or at wuwm.com/give, you're not only supporting the great local context you get on national and international stories like the ones we've been listening to on today's Lake Effect, but you're also supporting programs like Fresh Air, which comes your way in just a few seconds, like Here and Now, which comes your way in just a little while, and programs like All Things Considered, and even the weekend programs that you rely on to make your life just a little bit richer, things like Car Talk and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and Ask Me Another. Call us now, 414-227-3210. Take just a couple of minutes out of your busy schedules to make this winter membership drive a success. Go to wuwm.com/give.
And even though Kip Friedman would not like us to say this, we'd like you to be part of the equation and help us achieve that goal.
We try to stray away from jargon, but sometimes it's necessary. So do become part of the equation and take advantage of this opportunity right now to become a member or renew your membership in Milwaukee Public Radio. 414-227-3210 or wuwm.com/give. That's Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, we'll try to take stock of some of the many developments in the education landscape that have taken place over this winter, plus another Olympic interview or two. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh Air is next. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.